Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are charting a really necessary course through something we're calling the invisible border.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the complex and honestly rapidly changing data compliance landscape in the UK now that we're a few years post-Brexit.
It's a huge reality check for international organizations.
Yeah.
I mean, if you thought UK compliance was just a copy-paste of the EU's GDPR, well...
That ship has sailed.
That ship has sailed, sunk, and is now a historical artifact.
Mm-hmm.
As of 2026, the rules aren't just different. They are actively engineered to be different. They demand specific, localized action from anyone selling goods, offering services, or, you know, even just monitoring individuals in the UK.
The invisible border. That sounds exactly right. But let's be honest, a lot of organizations in New York, Tokyo, or even just across the water in Frankfurt, they probably assume that if they have solid EU GDPR compliance, they're basically covered in the UK, right?
And that assumption is so dangerously wrong in 2026.
Yeah.
Because the UK isn't just a jurisdiction that sort of kept the old laws. It's become an active regulatory island, and it started legislating for its own domestic economic priorities. We've got our hands on a fantastic analysis dated just this month, January 8, 2026, which maps out exactly how this environment has shifted from, you know, static rules to this diverging legal framework.
Okay, so our mission today is to cut right through that complexity. We want to give you actionable intelligence. We're going to focus on two non-negotiable legal pillars that international organizations absolutely have to master immediately.
Pillar number one is what I call fundamental security. It's the requirement of appointing a UK GDPR representative under what's called Article 27. This is your shield. It's what protects you from, frankly, catastrophic administrative fines.
And pillar number two is more about operational agility.
Exactly. It's about adapting to the completely new rulebook laid out by the Data Use and Access Act, or the DUAA, which is now fully operational. This is the new playbook for customer interaction and data use that changes, well, pretty much everything from your cookie policies to how you handle customer complaints.
And the key insight we really need to get across right at the top is this. If you are still relying on a generic, one-size-fits-all EU privacy standard,
you are at a profound competitive disadvantage in the UK market.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a legal technicality anymore. It's a business problem. And we're going to show you precisely why that's true.
Okay, let's start with that foundational shield then, Article 27, because this feels like the prerequisite for everything else. And it's where so many companies outside the UK, even ones with really good privacy programs, just fall down.
We have to begin with a big shift that happened on paper years ago. But the real world consequences are only now, you know, being fully felt. When the UK formally left the EU, it instantly became what's legally known as a third country for data protection purposes.
And that third country label is the trigger for all these extra administrative layers, isn't it? Even though the UK kept the UK GDPR, which, as you said, looks a lot like the original EU version.
Exactly. The UK GDPR is now a domestic UK law, totally separate from EU law.
Mm.
And the moment that split happened, the UK required foreign organizations. So, those without an established physical presence, to nominate a local point of contact.
Right, to make sure the UK regulators could still actually enforce the law against a company that might be operating from halfway across the world.
Precisely. It closes that enforcement loophole.
So this brings us to this invisible requirement. Who exactly gets caught in this net? Because I think a lot of people misunderstand this. They think it only applies to, say, a company in China or Australia. But it absolutely includes companies in Ireland, Germany, or the U.S.
Oh, absolutely. The requirement catches any organization based anywhere outside the U.K., and that includes the EU that has no physical office, branch, or established presence in the U.K. This is the crucial trigger.
The lack of a physical U.K. base.
Yes. If you have an entity, even a small dedicated office in London, you might be exempt because the regulator, the ICO, can just go knock on that door. But if you're managing your UK operations remotely, you must appoint a representative.
But operating remotely is the default for so many modern digital businesses. So it's really the activity criteria that sweeps almost everyone in, correct?
Yes, the activity criteria are incredibly broad. The requirement kicks in if the organization does one of two things. First, if you offer goods or services to people in the UK.
And that's broad, right? It's not just paid services.
Incredibly broad. It includes services offered for free, like a free app download or newsletter subscription that's clearly aimed at a UK audience.
Okay, and the second criterion. That one seems to catch pretty much everyone else who's on the internet.
It's the digital sweep, exactly. The second criterion is if you monitor the behavior of individuals in the UK. This covers way more than people think.
So not just cookies.
Not just the obvious analytics cookies. It's tracking pixels, server logs, personalized email services, heat maps that show you how UK visitors navigate your website. I mean, any form of behavioral profiling you might use for marketing or just to, you know, make your site work better.
So if a sauce company in California is tracking the conversion rates of its UK visitors,
they need a representative.
Or a German e-commerce platform uses dynamic pricing based on a shopper's location in, say, Manchester.
They're monitoring behavior. They need a representative. It is an absolute non-delegable legal duty.
It is absolute. Okay. And we have to be really clear about what this representative actually is. The source we're looking at warns they are not a data protection officer, a DPO.
This is a very common point of confusion. Their roles are distinct, but they should be complementary. A DPO works internally. They're focused on audits, compliance documentation, internal policy. The representative is your external conduit.
Can you just elaborate on that difference in purpose? I mean, why can't the company's DPO in Germany just handle the UK inquiries?
Because the primary purpose of the representative is to accept liability and legal service. They are the mandated formal link between the foreign company, the UK regulator, which is the Information Commissioner's Office, the ICO, and UK individuals themselves. Their role is purely about having a local legal presence.
That distinction really highlights the gravity of the role. They're not just fielding questions, they're fielding lawsuits and enforcement notices.
They are, which is why the formality of their appointment is paramount. The representative has to be authorized in writing. There's a formal mandate, often called the Article 27 appointment letter, and that letter gives them the legal power to accept service of legal proceedings on the foreign company's behalf.
So when the ICO decides it needs to issue an urgent order to stop processing data or an immediate enforcement notice, they send it to that local representative.
Yes. And the legal clock starts ticking immediately. It doesn't matter what the time zone is in the foreign headquarters or whether the CEO has actually opened their email.
Right. It legally guarantees the foreign company can't just claim, oh, we didn't see it in time, or simply fail to respond.
And there's more. Their contact details, the representative's address and email, have to be clearly and prominently published in the organization's public privacy policy. This ensures any UK consumer, or the ICO itself, knows exactly who to contact locally without having to hunt for it.
You also mentioned an internal operational duty that connects the representative directly to the company's accountability framework, the ROPA duty.
Yes, the Record of Processing Activities, or ROPA. You can think of the ROPA as the company's definitive data map. It details what data you collect, where it's stored, why you process it, and who you share it with.
It's the master document.
It is. And the representative must hold an up-to-date copy of this ROPA, ready to show the ICO upon request.
That detail is fascinating. It actually forces the foreign company to be in constant communication with its representative about its internal data mapping. Mm. It ensures the rep is informed and can't just be a simple, you know, mailbox service.
It transfers a really heavy operational documentation burden directly onto that local representative. If the organization processes a lot of UK personal data, that ROPA will be a huge, complex document. The rep needs to be able to access it, understand it, and crucially, present that detailed mapping to the ICO without delay.
And if the ROPA is out of date or they can't find it?
The foreign company is in breach of Article 27, even if they have, on paper, appointed a representative.
Okay, let's talk about the cold, hard implications of just ignoring this. The enforcement warning in the source material is pretty stark. It basically characterizes failing to appoint a representative as ghosting the regulator.
That's the perfect word for it. The ICO is tasked with enforcing UK law in the UK. If an international company is operating here but deliberately makes itself impossible to contact for legal service, the regulator sees that as an overt act of non-cooperation. And, well, they're not very patient.
And they've learned the tactics, right? They know how companies might try to create administrative distance.
They do. We're seeing more and more cases where the ICO just proceeds with enforcement actions anyway, sending the notice to the foreign headquarters. But here's the critical bit. The missed deadline.
Oh.
Because the company's overseas, maybe relying on international mail or just slow internal routing systems, they are highly likely to miss the time-critical deadlines that are embedded in that legal demand.
Which means they default on the requirement without even knowing it until the fine lands on their desk.
Exactly. Missing that deadline, failing to provide a ROPA, failing to respond to an inquiry because of bad routing, it all stems from that one fundamental failure to have a local, mandated, and swift point of contact.
So let's get to the number that grounds this whole discussion. What is the fine specifically for being in breach of Article 27 for the failure to appoint a local representative?
The penalty is severe, and it's severe because this failure strikes at the very core of the regulator's authority. The fine can be up to $8.7 million, or 2% of global annual turnover, whichever is higher.
Wow. Okay, that's a staggering figure for what is purely administrative non-compliance. It's not a fine for leaking millions of customer records. It's a fine for not having the right name on a legal document in the UK.
It just emphasizes how the UK views the mechanism of accountability as absolutely non-negotiable. If you want access to our market, you have to pay the small administrative cost of being reachable. As we'll discuss, appointing a third-party professional representative is essentially the cheapest insurance policy you can buy against this kind of multi-million pound fine.
Okay, so that establishes the shield, the mandatory presence of that Article 27 representative. Now let's turn to the sharp new sword they have to wield, the operational rules under the Data Use and Access Act, or DUAA. This is the divergence moment.
This is the moment the UK effectively says we are no longer just mirroring the EU, we are actively optimizing our framework for the UK economy. It's fully operational in 2026, and it sits alongside and specifically amends the UK GDPR and the Data Protection Act 2018.
Let's just clarify the hierarchy here. If the UK GDPR is the car, is the DUAA replacing the engine, or is it just like tuning the performance settings?
It's definitely tuning the performance settings and maybe installing some optional high-performance parts. The foundational engine, the core principles of transparency, data minimization, security, that's all still the unshakable framework of UK GDPR. But the DUAA changes the operational mechanisms of compliance.
How you do things.
How you do things. How you talk to people, how you handle certain requests, and what data you can use for what purposes. It's a series of really major amendments.
Okay, let's drive right into the four specific practical changes that organizations have to integrate into their compliance manuals right now. Change number one, a new complaint handling statutory duty.
This is all about reducing friction for the consumer and demanding a rapid response from the company. The DUAA imposes a statutory duty on organizations to provide a clear, easy way for individuals to complain about how their data is being used. It's an attempt to channel that consumer frustration efficiently before it escalates to the ICO.
And this duty lands squarely on the shoulders of the UK representative.
Absolutely. The representative will be the first port of call. And this isn't just about having an email inbox. The organization has to have a robust process, a whole system ready to ensure a substantive official response to that complaint within one calendar month.
30 days. Regardless of how complex the complaint is, or any language barriers, or the time zone difference between London and the foreign headquarters, that is a hard deadline.
It is a statutory window that requires rapid, organized mobilization. I mean, think about a company based in Silicon Valley. A complaint arrives with their representative in London at 5 p.m. The U.S. team gets it at 9 a.m. their time, but maybe the complaint needs input from the product team in India and the legal team over in Europe.
Right.
If the internal routing or language translation takes a week, you've already lost a quarter of your statutory window. The risk of missing that deadline means you need to have real-time, mandatory coordination drills between the representative and the parent company.
So if the representative is just forwarding emails and, you know, hoping for the best?
The organization is quickly exposed to a failure to meet this new statutory duty, creating a whole new specific risk of non-compliance under the DUAA.
Okay, moving on to change number two, subject access requests, or SARs reform. The EU standard usually requires organizations to provide access to personal data unless the request is manifestly unfounded or excessive. But the DUAA changes that standard. It adopts a reasonable and proportionate test. What does that subtle language change actually allow in practice?
Well, it's a significant business-friendly shift. It's aimed at cutting down on administrative burden. Under the DUAA, organizations can now refuse a SAR if carrying out requires what the law calls unreasonable effort. The new standard recognizes the technological reality that, you know, retrieving every single piece of data from a decades-old legacy system might be completely disproportionate to the individual's right to access.
So the complexity of the law isn't the excuse. The representative's job is to explain the proportionality argument convincingly, or the organization is exposed.
That is the big operational challenge here. You can't just declare, oh, this is too hard. The representative has to articulate why the effort is unreasonable and disproportionate. For example, they might have to explain that the request would require a 10-person team working for 4 weeks to manually sift through unstructured data from a decommissioned system.
Costing a fortune.
Costing hundreds of thousands of pounds. An effort that's grossly disproportionate to the benefit of receiving that data.
And if the response is just full of legal jargon or sounds evasive, the regulator or the individual will just escalate it.
And if they fail to convey that reason convincingly, the organization risks an ICO challenge, which then forces them to justify the refusal anyway, and that could incur far greater legal costs than just providing the data in the first place. The representative really needs some high-level communication skills to articulate this cost-benefit analysis in plain English.
Okay, here's where the DUAA really starts creating some competitive separation. Change number 3, the cookie pop-up relaxation. This is arguably the most visible and impactful divergence from the EU model for everyday users.
This is the UK signaling a major pro-business stance. The core change is simple. Consent is no longer legally required for analytics or for functional cookies.
So these are the cookies that just make the site work, remember your login, or collect basic anonymous usage stats.
Exactly. That instantly removes a massive barrier for UK site visitors. No more of those annoying multi-layered consent banners just for fundamental site performance tracking. Consent is now only legally required for tracking and ads, specifically cookies used for targeted marketing or third-party data sharing.
So any foreign company that deals with UK traffic has to immediately update their UK-specific cookie banners.
He must.
And this has huge implications for businesses, doesn't it? Particularly for data collection and user conversion rates. If a US company is still using a generic, one-size-fits-all EU banner that forces consent for basic analytics,
they're instantly handicapping themselves in the UK market. They're paying what you could call a friction penalty. Every layer of consent you force a user through reduces conversion rates, it drives up bounce rates, and it makes your basic analytics data less reliable because it's only based on the people who bother to consent.
Meanwhile, your competitor, who's optimized their banner for the DUAA rules, may be displaying a simple notification or no banner at all for functional use. They get a competitive edge. They get richer, frictionless, and legally acquired analytics data. This is compliance becoming a commercial advantage.
But the technical implementation has to be precise. You have to geolocate the user, serve the right banner, and make sure that only your advertising cookies are the ones that require that specific, explicit consent. Your privacy policies have to clearly delineate between the two as well.
Okay, finally, change number 4, the clarification of recognized legitimate interests. This sounds like it's about making the legal basis for processing data less bureaucratic, more predictable.
That's exactly it. Previously, if you wanted to rely on legitimate interests as your reason for processing data, you had to do this rigorous, subjective, and highly documented balancing test, the Legitimate Interest Assessment, or LIA. You had to weigh your company's interest against the individual's fundamental rights.
And regulators would often question those.
All the time. So the DUAA provides clarity by creating a shortcut for specific activities. It provides a pre-approved statutory list of activities where that balancing test is essentially deemed satisfied by the law itself. It removes a huge amount of legal uncertainty.
And what are the main examples of these pre-approved activities?
Well, the source points to really critical areas. Fraud prevention, maintaining network security, so cyber defense and emergency data sharing, like for a public health crisis. For these specific things, the organization no longer needs to go through that lengthy subjective LIA. They could just cite the DUAA recognized legitimate interest.
But to get this benefit, they have to update their documentation to reflect this UK-specific basis, right? To prove they've actually done their homework.
That's absolutely critical. If you get audited, you have to show you didn't just passively assume it was fine, but that you actively adopted the specific allowance from the new UK law. Europa and your public privacy notices must explicitly state that the processing is based on a recognized legitimate interest under the DUAA. It just shows proactive, targeted compliance.
Okay, we've covered the mandatory shield and the operational agility from the DUAA amendments. Now let's connect these changes to some tangible business scenarios. I want to focus on how the UK representative becomes this essential local channel for compliance, especially where new laws start to intersect with data privacy.
This is where it gets really multi-layered. Data compliance is no longer a siloed legal thing. It's intrinsically tied to consumer affairs, competition policy, technological development. The representative has to be fluent in all these intersections.
Let's start with e-commerce and retail. They now have to integrate the new Digital Markets, Competition and Consumers Act, the DMCC Act, with their data handling.
The DMCC Act, which is now fully enforceable, is a major regulatory push against, abuses of consumer trust online. It targets things like hidden subscription traps.
Oh, we've all been there.
Where cancellation is made deliberately difficult, and also the systemic use of fake reviews to manipulate what people buy.
So consumers are using data-driven dark patterns to complain about. Dark patterns. How does this cycle pull the GDPR representative into the fight?
It creates this crucial dual role for them. UK consumers who want to get things fixed will naturally go to the most accessible local contact point they can find, the Article 27 representative, to exercise both their privacy rights and their consumer rights.
Can you give us a concrete example of this intersection?
Sure. Imagine a consumer signs up for a free trial of an online service, but when they try to cancel before the auto renewal, the cancellation link is broken, or it requires them to make 5 mandatory phone calls, a classic subscription trap under the DMCC. That consumer is going to complain to the representative. They'll say, "I can't cancel, and you are misusing my payment data and my personal profile data to unlawfully extend my subscription."
Ah, so the complaint arrives as both a GDPR issue, unlawful processing of payment data, failure to allow data erasure, and a DMCC issue, which is an unfair commercial practice. The representative can't just deal with the data part.
Exactly. They have to understand the crucial intersection. If they ignore the DMCC aspect and only address the GDPR part, they leave their foreign company exposed to the Competition and Markets Authority, the CMA, which oversees the DMCC. The representative is the front line for these consumer rights complaints and needs training in both areas.
That drastically expands the skill set required. They're not just a GDPR specialist anymore. They have to be a compliance generalist.
They're the local risk manager. Their response has to trigger an internal fix that addresses the underlying consumer rights problem immediately, preventing a regulatory escalation under either framework.
Okay, next up, technology and AI. The DOAA made some big changes to automated decision making, or ADM, allowing its use for significant decisions without explicit consent, as long as the right safeguards are in place. This feels like a massive liberalization of AI use compared to the EU.
It's a very clear signal that the UK wants to encourage tech adoption. Traditionally, using a fully automated process to make a significant decision, like rejecting a credit application, denying insurance, or automatically filtering job candidates, was highly restricted under GDPR. It often required explicit user consent.
And the DOAA removes that high hurdle, letting organizations leverage AI for efficiency, but only if the safeguards are robust.
Absolutely. The liberalization is conditional on strict accountability. Individuals keep their fundamental right to challenge these automated decisions, to demand human intervention, and a full explanation of why the decision was made.
And that challenge, of course, goes straight to the representative.
Straight to the representative.
This feels like maybe the most difficult task the representative will face, explaining algorithmic logic to a layperson who's just been rejected for something important.
It requires deep organizational knowledge and the ability to translate technical concepts under, extreme pressure. The representative has to be equipped to receive these challenges and immediately explain the organization's logic of processing to that individual.
How deep does that explanation have to be? Do they have to reveal the proprietary algorithm code?
No, they don't have to reveal trade secrets. But they do have to explain the input variables and the structure of the decision-making model in terms someone can understand. For example, if an algorithm rejected a loan application, the representative must explain that the algorithm placed weight on factors like current debt-to-income ratio, length of time at their current address, and a lack of previous credit history. They have to show how these variables led to the adverse decision.
So they're translating between the algorithm and the human regulatory system. If they can't speak the language of the algorithm, this new freedom that the DOAA gives is, well, it's functionally useless because the company will be challenged constantly.
Failure to provide a clear, prompt explanation completely nullifies the benefit of the ADM liberalization.
Mm-hmm.
The representative is acting as the accountability firewall, verifying that the human element of governance is still present in the automated system.
Finally, let's look at life sciences and research. This sector is benefiting from the introduction of broad consent under the DOAA, which is a huge structural benefit for medical research.
This change is specifically designed to accelerate medical innovation. Historically, research projects often face these crippling administrative burdens because if the scope of a study changed even slightly, say you decide to analyze the data for a related but secondary condition, you sometimes had to reconsent all the participants under the strict GDPR rules.
Which, for long-term trials that span decades, is often just impossible. Participants have moved, they're unresponsive, or they've passed away, and valuable research gets derailed.
The DOAA's broad consent solves this. It allows organizations to seek initial consent from patients for their data to be used for a broad category of related scientific research. For example, for all future cancer research, instead of only for Trial X. This means they don't have to reconsent patients for every minor change within that agreed scope.
That removes a massive legal and logistical hurdle for researchers. It makes the UK a really attractive hub for medical data usage.
It does. But even with this regulatory relief, trust is still paramount. And the representative's role here shifts to one of, you know, ethical assurance and relationship maintenance. They act as the trusted local contact point for trial participants.
So if a participant reads about a new related study using their data under this broad consent model, they might feel a bit uneasy and want some immediate local clarity.
Exactly. They need a local human face, the representative, who can provide reassurance, clarify the original scope of the consent, and explain the security measures used to protect their data. The representative sustains that vital relationship with the participant and stops localized anxiety from escalating into formal regulatory complaints.
That was an excellent breakdown of how the DUAA changes things across different sectors. Let's move to our final section and synthesize all of this complex information into clear, critical implementation questions. This is where we distill the practical, actionable takeaways.
Let's do it. Let's address the three most common points of confusion that international organizations are facing right now as they try to formalize their 2026 compliance strategies.
Okay, question one. A multinational headquartered in Chicago has a small operational sales office in London, which is structured as a local UK subsidiary. Can that subsidiary legally act as the UK GDPR representative for the parent company in Chicago?
The short answer is yes, they can. But the long answer involves a strategic cost-benefit analysis. Legally, the subsidiary has to be a distinct legal entity established in the UK. If it meets that test, it fulfills the geographic requirement of Article 27.
So why do so many sophisticated organizations still prefer to hire a third-party professional representative, even when they have a local entity they could use? What's the strategic trade-off?
The trade-off is liability exposure. It's this concept of ring fencing.
Mm-hmm.
If the subsidiary acts as the representative and the parent company suffers a massive Article 27 non-compliance fine, or if a data breach happens, liability for that penalty can potentially flow directly to that local operational subsidiary.
Meaning the local sales office, which might only have a turnover of a few million pounds, could suddenly be on the hook for a fine based on the global turnover of the U.S. parent company, or have its local assets frozen.
Precisely. And that risk is just unacceptable for many large firms. They prefer to appoint a neutral, third-party professional representative, a firm that specializes only in this legal service. This structure acts like a lightning rod. It's legally distinct from their operational UK entity.
So it protects the operational subsidiary.
It protects the subsidiary and its assets from regulatory penalty exposure flowing from the parent company's data practices. It's a strategic de-risking measure. It's ring-fencing that liability.
That makes the cost of a professional representative seem pretty minimal compared to a potential $8.7 million fine hitting your main UK operating entity.
It shifts the exposure from an operational asset to a contractual service. And that is always the preferred structure for international legal risk management.
Okay. Question two. We've established that the DUAA introduces major changes to SARs, cookies, and legitimate interests. Does this new Data Use and Access Act entirely replace the UK GDPR? Should legal teams start phasing out UK GDPR language?
Absolutely not. And this is a critical point of clarity. The DUAA does not replace the UK GDPR. It acts as a comprehensive set of amendments to the UK GDPR and the Data Protection Act 2018.
So the foundation remains. The core principles of security, data minimization, accuracy, accountability, all of that still mandates the majority of the compliance effort.
Exactly. You still need a robust foundation built on those overarching principles. The DUAA just recalibrates the mechanisms of compliance, how you interact with the public, how you respond to requests, and how you document your lawful basis.
Mm.
It's an evolutionary tuning, not a revolutionary replacement. Your compliance manuals still need to start with UK GDPR. The DUAA is just the necessary update layer on top.
Question three addresses the unavoidable geopolitical reality. Do we need separate representatives for the EU and the UK?
If an organization, let's say an American tech platform, sells goods or monitors users across the entire European continent, meaning both the EU and the UK, and has no physical presence in either region, then the answer is a definitive yes.
Since Brexit, there are two entirely separate regulatory systems with separate ultimate enforcement bodies.
Correct. They are separate jurisdictions. There are regulators, the ICO in the UK, and the various supervisory authorities across the 27 EU member states. They do not share a representative system. You have to appoint one representative established in the UK for the ICO. And you must appoint a separate representative established in an EU member state for the EU authorities. One cannot serve both functions.
That doubles the administrative requirement, but it's just the necessary cost of market access in both major European economies if you don't have an office. It's the unavoidable reality of that invisible border.
It is the unavoidable reality.
Okay, let's pivot to the final actionable steps. Given that the DUAA is fully operational in 2026, what are the two immediate practical steps that any international organization trading in the UK must undertake right now?
The time for strategic review is now. The first step addresses that foundational requirement we covered at the very beginning, formalizing the administrative shield.
Which means drafting the Article 27 appointment letter.
That's right. You need to draft and execute the formal written mandate required by law to appoint your UK representative. This document has to clearly define the representative's authority to act on your behalf for all GDPR and DUAA matters, especially regarding enforcement actions. This document is your foundational insurance policy against that major administrative fine.
And the second step forces the operational overhaul that the DUAA requires.
Step two is undertaking a comprehensive 2026 gap analysis. This assessment compares your company's current operational procedures and public documents, which are often, you know, modeled on generic EU rules, against the specific requirements and allowances of the UK DUAA.
And what are the three non-negotiable areas this gap analysis must focus on to make sure organizations move from passive compliance to proactive, localized compliance?
First, the complaints handling mechanism. You have to verify that your system ensures that 30-day statutory response is feasible. That means swift internal routing, clear responsibilities, and appropriate language translation capacity.
Second, the high-stakes competitive advantage point, cookies.
You need to check if your cookie banners are configured specifically for the UK market to exploit the relaxation rules for analytics and functional cookies. If you are still running a generic EU banner, you are losing valuable, legally available data, and you're introducing unnecessary user friction.
And third, the legal documentation, making sure you leverage those streamlined processes.
Precisely. You must ensure that your lawful base is documented in your ROPA and your public privacy notices, specifically cite the new UK recognized legitimate interests for things like fraud prevention and network security. This proves you have actively integrated the DUAA amendments into your legal posture.
So this gap analysis forces the organization to move from assuming compliance because they're close to the EU to actively proving compliance based on specific UK legal provisions.
The UK framework demands specificity, and 2026 is the year where that demand translates into either competitive opportunity or punitive fines.
So let's bring it all back to you, the listener. We've covered the necessity of the UK representative as the shield against those non-negotiable Article 27 fines. And remember, 8.7 million is the cost of being unreachable. And we've outlined the critical operational importance of adjusting your notices and procedures, SARs, cookies, and complaint handling, to exploit the DUAA's specific business-friendly allowances.
The UK is actively defining a new model of data regulation, one that rewards efficiency but harshly punishes evasion. We're seeing a simultaneous push for easier data use for businesses through things like cookie relaxation, while at the same time demanding hyper-localized, robust accountability, especially where new regulations intersect with data, like the DMCC for retail and the ADM challenge requirements for tech.
It's a compelling paradox, isn't it? A lighter touch on certain data usage, but a heavier demand on the local compliance structure. It rewards specificity and speed.
It forces international organizations to stop treating the UK as an administrative afterthought and start treating it as a uniquely regulated, high-value market that demands bespoke compliance solutions.
Which brings us to our final provocative thought for you. The UK is actively trying to become the most attractive location for data-driven commerce in Europe. The question you need to be mulling over right now is this. How quickly can your internal legal framework stop thinking GDPR generally and start thinking DUAA specific to maximize your competitive advantage in the UK market? The difference between generic and specific compliance is now measured in millions of pounds and, crucially, in frictionless data points that your competition may already be acquiring.
Don't let that invisible border become the wall that limits your access or exposes your organization to an unnecessary penalty. Formalize your local representation and execute that 2026 gap analysis immediately.
That was the deep dive into the UK's diverging data landscape. We'll see you next time.